Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In just the past decade, winemaking innovations have brought the enjoyment of great-tasting wine to even more of the masses. But the history of wine goes back farther than written record, farther than anyone can measure, for sure. And the human relationship with wine has changed immensely during that time. Joining us now to talk about that is Paul Lucas. He's a James Beard Award winner, author of American Vintage and the Great Wines of America. He also is a professor of English at Loyola University of Maryland. His latest book is called Simply Inventing Wine. Welcome to the show, Paul.
It's great to be talking with you.
Why the use of the word inventing in the title?
Because wine is, on the one hand, a natural product, but on the other hand, and I think the more important side of it, is that it is a human invention. Not the product itself so much as what we do with it. And one of the really interesting things about the history of wine is that human beings have done all kinds of very different things with wine over the ages.
Early on, I mean, what do we know, or do we know anything about how old wine is?
As best we know, and this archaeological work is fairly recent, so it may go farther back than we know now, but as best we know, wine is roughly 8,000 years old, which is pretty darned old.
That's pretty darned old, exactly. And what did we do with it back then?
Wine in the ancient world, regardless of the very different civilizations and cultures in the ancient world, whether Sumeria or Babylon or ancient Egypt and eventually Greece and Rome, wine was invariably, let's see what exactly the right word would be, it was invariably infused with a spiritual or religious aspect. It was believed to be a gift from God or the gods. And it was believed to have elements of the gods or divinity within it, so that when one drank wine, one wasn't drinking what we think of as now an interesting social beverage. One was drinking one's maker.
So it was considered something of a spiritual manifestation, something from the gods. But why wine? Why not beer? Which is another natural.
Which is, well, beer is a natural product, except that unlike wine, beer needs human agency.
Okay.
That's to say, beer needs to be cooked. You can't take barley, throw it down on a rock, and produce beer. You have to cook it. People have to do something. With wine, if a bunch of grapes falls to the ground from a gust of wind going by or an animal brushing the grapes or some such thing, the grapes will fall to the ground, the skins will split open, and wine will start being produced. So to the ancient mind or minds, there was something really magical about this. They certainly honored beer, and beer was more widely drunk in many ancient cultures than wine was. And they had in certain cultures, in ancient Sumeria, for example, there was a god who was honored for bringing the knowledge of how to make beer to human beings. But that's very different from the wine gods, who were honored for making the product themselves.
When you talk about our knowledge or our, what we think was wine 8,000 years ago, how do we know that? What's the evidence for that? Is it just vestiges of it in chemical experiments?
We know of it through archaeological digs, so that we know that the first people, at least that we know of so far, who deliberately made wine instead of observing this strange juice on the ground that bees were buzzing around, but who deliberately made wine, were people in what geographers call Transcaucasia, present-day Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, northern Iran, eastern Turkey, south of the Caucasus Mountains and in between the Caspian and the Black Seas. That's where these archaeological discoveries have been made. And evidence of wine in rudimentary clay jars has been found, so that we know we can date it that way. And then we can get a sense of what their cultures did with the wine. We can't go quite that far back, but in Babylon, in Sumeria, in Egypt, etc., through written texts, through religious rituals, through the way people talk about wine in all of those very different civilizations.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Lucas. He's author of Inventing Wine. If you have a question or comment for Paul, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So did wine pop up about the same time in all of those different areas you mentioned?
No, it spreads, as best we can figure out. One always says that caveat because all these archaeological discoveries are fairly recent within the last generation or so. But as best we can figure out, wine starts in that Transcaucasian region, and then it gradually spreads south, east, and west. It doesn't go north because the Caucasus Mountains sort of block the spread of grape growing and winemaking going north. But it goes down into what is present-day Iran, into Persia. It goes east into Central Asia. It goes west into what it would be present-day Turkey, and then into the Middle East, into Egypt, and then to Greece, and eventually to Rome.
It was interesting to read about how container innovation played something of a role in the history of wine. We're going through another renovation, it seems like, now with the screw caps. But back in the day, having that long neck, or there was something about the neck of the bottle and how it was contained that kept it minimized oxygenation and that sort of thing?
Well, there weren't any bottles.
The
bottles for wine, glass bottles for wine, are an early 18th century invention. Fairly recent in the long history of wine, but there were the crucial factor for people in the ancient world was to try to prevent wine from spoiling. Wine will spoil very quickly, as we all know. If you leave a glass of wine out from a dinner party the night before, it's not going to taste as good the next day, and it's going to taste really bad the next week because it's going to start turning into vinegar. It's going to start becoming sour and acidic. And the big problem for ancient winemakers was that their wines soured quickly. There was only one harvest a year, so if they picked the grapes and fermented the juice in, let's say, September, by the end of October, it was pretty sour and vinegary. So they did all kinds of things to try to prevent souring. One was to try to put wine in containers that would let as little air as possible in them. And the classic example of this are the amphorae, which were first invented in ancient Egypt and then spread throughout the Mediterranean. There were other examples. There were different kinds of jars and pots and things that held wine, and they tried to seal them with rags and grass and reeds and tar and all kinds of different products. They were never all that successful doing so. But they also added all kinds of things to wine. They added everything from spices to marble dust to lead to which became very popular, to pitch from pine trees and resin, boiled pitch, and all in an effort to make the wine not taste sour and acrid. So it's a very different substance that we drink today than what was drunk back then. Back then, wine tended to be fairly thick because it had all this pine salty stuff in it.
Thick like honey?
Often as thick as honey.
Okay.
Because of what had been added to it, not because what the grapes produced, but
right,
what had been added to it. It tended to be thick. It tended to be the more prized wines tended to be quite sweet. They often had honey added to them, or dates or other kinds of sweet fruits added, and sweet spices. And it invariably had at its base very sour, acrid, acidic, oxidized fermented grape juice. I mean, just imagine the grapes are picked in September. What the heck, the stuff must have tasted like the next summer when you're really thirsty because it's hot. Nonetheless, people drank wine from morning till night. Babies drank it, old men and old women drank it, everybody drank it. And the reason they drank it was because, especially when living in villages, they didn't have anything else to drink.
There was no water, or that it was safer than the water?
It was safer than the water, because if you live in the village, both human and animal waste goes into the water.
Would the tradition of sangria be explained that way, as far as adding things like fruit to it to make it taste better?
Through a convoluted route, I would say. I mean, sangria, something like sangria, comes really out of the vogue in the 18th century for punch, which would be wine and fruits and spices, and often back then, hard spirits also added to the beverage. And out of that comes something like sangria. But the idea of using wine and mixing it with other things goes way, way back.
When you talk about where wine originated from, as best we know, it's interesting that how it's come to be regarded the way it has in the Muslim religion. And I was wondering if you could talk about how that came about.
Towards the end of what we would call antiquity, towards the end of, say, classical Greece on, wine becomes more widely distributed. Until then, it was really the province of religious and political authorities, of the nobility and of the priests. Wine becomes much more widely consumed in the polis of the Greek city-states and then in Imperial Rome. It is always has a double character. It is something marked by God. The great examples, of course, of the wine gods are Dionysus and Bacchus in Greece and Rome. Mm-hmm. And to drink wine is to drink Dionysus. But there is at the same time a great fear of drinking to excess. And the Muslim world, which emerges out of what's left of the Roman world, venerates wine. The Quran is filled with passages that venerate wine, and they praise wine, but as something that will exist in the hereafter for you. It's something too dangerous or too tempting for mortal men and women to consume on earth, because they will invariably succumb to its temptations. Whereas after death in paradise, you will swim in rivers of wine and have wine brought to you day and night, because you then will be in the afterlife and will not have the temptation of overindulgence and drunkenness facing you.
Incorporating it into a religion that way must suggest that drunkenness, alcoholism, was a big problem with the consumption of wine and, I suppose, beer.
I think it was a problem. I think it was more, though, something that the authorities feared. So that, for example, the many, many biblical references to wine, ancient Israel is compared to a grapevine. The Israelites are compared to fruit on that vine. But the repeated claim is that people who drink to excess are barbarians and pagans. Civilized people drink wine. They drink wine all the time, but they don't. And when I say they drink wine all the time, you might think, well, they must be drunk all the time. Mm-hmm. But they drink wine all the time, cut significantly with water, so that wine in these ancient worlds was invariably mixed with 2, 3, 4 times as much water, because not to improve the wine so much as to make the water safer to drink. That's in the sense in which it was served to young children and to babies and all the rest of it. Whereas people who would drink wine straight and would drink too much of it were regarded as uncivilized. Thucydides writes that civilization comes when human beings learned how to plant vineyards. People who don't plant vineyards but just drink wine and drink it to excess are barbarians.
My guest is Paul Lucas. He's author of Inventing Wine. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We're talking about the history of wine. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, big powers want to chop up the global internet and put nations in charge. Russia, China, will look at the push to rein in the web. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 39 degrees, expect sunshine today and a high of 45. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 28. More sunshine and a high near 50 on Thursday. Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery and Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. More information is available online at themontgomerysolution.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Paul Lucas. He's the author of the book, Inventing Wine. We're talking about the history of wine today. If you have a question or comment for Paul Lucas, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Paul, just continuing along the issue of religion and wine, Catholics have a very different relationship with spirits in general and wine in particular. How does one religion go one direction and then something like the Catholics go in an altogether different direction?
Well, it's very interesting what happened with, we say Catholics today, but of course at the fall of the Roman Empire and the emergence of Christianity, all Christians were Catholics and vice versa. When Christianity becomes the dominant religion in Europe, one would think, and the sort of standard story is that the Christian church needs wine for its sacraments and therefore propagates grape growing and winemaking in Northern Europe and in places where it hadn't been before, in Eastern Europe, in Hungary, for example, or in what's now the Czech Republic, or in the Low Countries in Northern Europe. That's not really true, because the church doesn't need much wine. The Christian church distinguishes firmly between wine that is used for the sacrament on the altar and wine that is drunk outside the church in, say, a tavern or a home or a monastery or any place outside of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And paradoxically enough, it's the early Christian church that takes really the first big step towards modernizing wine in enabling most wine to be secular, to be a secular worldly good. A product of commerce, something one trades in, something one increasingly needs in order for sustenance, for calories, for nutrition, having nothing to do with the sacred or religious connotations. Connotations is really too weak. Sacred or religious essence that wine had in the ancient world and still had on the altar for the Christian church. But the Christian church said that the sacrament of transubstantiation, of turning wine into Christ's blood, was a sacrament that was available only to the priest, not to the laity, something that didn't change until the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
And increasingly kept wine, even for the priests, as something that was only drunk and really sipped on special occasions. So that there wasn't a lot of wine used in Christian ritual. The wine that was used in Christian ritual retained all of its magic and mystery and spiritual essence. But the vast majority of wine was drunk outside of the church, and often in vineyards owned by churches, as a kind of communal and social bonding. And so it was the very beginnings of wine becoming secular and wine becoming social, which we've inherited almost 2,000 years later.
Charles in Holmes County, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Hello. I'm assuming that you're a wine expert. This is somewhat of a historical question, but I purchased a perfectly sealed bottle of wine, vintage 1945. And I'm just curious as to how old a wine can be before it's still usable, or does it have any interest to anybody?
It depends on what the wine is. Do you know what the producer, who the producer is, or where the wine came from?
Yeah, it came from what I'm assuming by the label, and I'll spell it out: R-H-I-N, Chile, and the producer, I believe, is Dina Underaga. Is the best that I can pronounce it.
The Underaga Wine Company is a big wine company in Chile. It still exists. Wine in Chile in the 1940s was not very advanced scientifically. So the odds are pretty good, I'm sorry to say, that the wine itself is probably well past its prime. You might open it and try it as a curiosity, but my guess is it's going to be nothing much more than a curiosity.
Why do some wines, you talk about different, you know, you hear about old bottles of wine and tasting perfectly fine. What's the difference chemically between one from one like that that doesn't last?
There's no real difference chemically. There are differences in how the wine is made, in the science and technology of winemaking. The big difference between, say, the 1940s and today is that in the 1940s, in a place like Chile, there was very little refrigeration, so that the wine fermented at very hot temperatures. The wine was thus susceptible to oxidation very early, whereas today, any winery worth its salt has temperature-controlled fermentation vats, and is able to, vintners are able to monitor and control their craft in a way that they couldn't even, the 1940s are a while ago, but not that long ago in the history of wine, that people couldn't until the middle of the 20th century.
And Chilean wine in particular has really exploded.
It's exploded in popularity, and there's some superb wines coming
to
Chile.
Absolutely. Charles, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Take
care.
Bye-bye. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Paul Lucas, author of Inventing Wine. Questions or comments are welcome, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. John in Columbus, you're on the air with Paul Lucas. Welcome.
Is that for me?
Yes, welcome.
Okay, this is John. Okay, a couple of things he said reminded me, Paul, you said reminded me of apples. I had been told that they originated in Kazakhstan and moved west, which would be the same as the Transcaucasus area, and then also the bees buzzing around sounds like apples in an orchard. So what's the parallels? Do you know of any parallels between hard cider and wine and how people used it and that sort of thing?
Hard cider goes way back. I'm not sure exactly how far back. The other term, of course, for hard cider is apple wine. So it has much the same kind of history. It also is a natural product, and you know, living in Ohio, you probably see it all the time with, you know, in the fall, the apples fall down from the ground and the skin split open and they start, the juice of the apple starts fermenting and the bees buzz around and you see the frothy juice collecting there. Wine from grapes came a little earlier, I think, because grapes, of course, grew wild, as I assume apple trees did too, and I'm not sure when the first apple trees were cultivated by human beings. But the grapes were just more common, I think, in that area of the world. But it's a very similar process and a similar product. And certainly by the time we get to the Middle Ages, in Western Europe, in places where the climate isn't suitable for growing grapes, making wine out of apples is very popular in northern France, for example. Making wine, what we would call hard cider, out of apples it happens all the time.
Thank you, John.
Thanks.
Take care. What do we know about the first vineyard? Are there any vestiges of information out there regarding that kind of organized growing of grapes?
I don't think we know when the first cultivated vineyards occurred. We know that by the time we get to the Egyptian New Kingdom and the ancient pharaohs, that there were specific plots of land that are designated for growing vines. We know that this is true in some of the Greek islands, and we certainly know this was true in southern Italy during the heights of the Roman Empire. So the notion of finding specific places where one plants vineyards because of the alleged quality of the wine coming from them goes back at least that far.
What about on this continent? What do we know about grapes growing on this continent and using them for wine by the people who were here before the Europeans?
There's very little evidence that the Native Americans made wine out of wild grapes in North America, even though there are more wild grapes growing in North America than any place else in the world. There's been a lot of speculation as to why this would be true. Most North American cultures, Native North American cultures, so too many N's in that sentence. most Native North American cultures were not particularly prone to drinking alcohol in any form. There was corn beer in Central America and in Mexico, but there wasn't this kind of traditions of drink that existed in the West and in Europe. Most Native American grapes make pretty unpleasant tasting wine.
You mean also, the kind that grow naturally?
The kind that just grow on the side of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're driving up to Cleveland from Columbus, you'll see vines.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see some vineyards these days too, but you'll see just wild vines growing, and they make pretty unpleasant tasting wine. And this was the great challenge when European settlers came to North America. They were like, wow, look at all these grapes. It's going to be wonderful, but the wine tasted terrible. And when they brought European grapevines to America, the vines all died.
Now, I eat wild grapes when I find them out camping or hiking, and they taste good, but that doesn't translate necessarily into good wine.
It doesn't. They tend to be too sweet to make balanced, harmonious wines, and they tend to have, when they ferment, an odd flavor that is sometimes called a foxy flavor, and there's no consensus about exactly where that term came from. My favorite early use of it is in the 1800s, an Englishman in Virginia said, it tastes like the smell of a dead fox.
Which would have been more common back then than it is now.
Probably. We might just think roadkill.
Exactly. Peter in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I've got a question. My wife and I like Chardonnays, and I've heard that there is a technique to convert some of the acids to lactic acid. Can you tell me where that started and if that is denoted on all Chardonnays somehow? And also, can you elaborate a little bit about the oaky aspects of Chardonnay and how that's done? I'll take my answer off the line. Thank
you.
All right.
Thank you, Peter.
Sure. Chardonnay is a grape. It's the traditional grape of the traditional white wine grape of Burgundy in France, and so it has a long history and. Has made some of the world's most prized wines starting in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, continues to do so. Many people would argue that the best white Burgundies are the best white wines in the world, or among the best white wines in the world. In the last generation or two, it has spread all across the world, and there is now Chardonnay grown in every continent except Antarctica. And wine made from it has become immensely popular. One process used in making wine with Chardonnay sometimes is called malolactic fermentation, and that's, I think, what the caller was referring to, in that the Chardonnay is a quite acidic grape, and this is a process in which the tart malic acid is converted into lactic acid, and it makes the wine taste softer, more lush, more buttery, a lot of the things that people like about Chardonnay. The process occurs completely naturally. It needs the right temperature to get started, but it was only discovered as a specific chemical process by French scientists and other scientists, but by primarily French scientists, in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, so fairly recently. Not all wine made out of Chardonnay undergoes this process. There's nothing on a label that would indicate if it did or it didn't. It's a stylistic choice of the winemaker whether to do this or not. In the same way as the stylistic choice of the winemaker whether or not to put the wine in new oak barrels, which will impart a really distinct oaky flavor, or to put them in older oak barrels, which won't impart much of a wooden flavor at all. Those are stylistic choices that the winemaker has. They're also economic choices, because new oak barrels cost a lot of money. But they're choices that the winemaker has in order to make wine to a certain preconceived style. And so they wouldn't be indicated necessarily on the label.
Well, that sounds, it's right up your alley. Trudy, welcome to the show.
Good morning. I've got a question, and how long ago did winemakers start to use oak barrels?
People used wood casks, not necessarily made out of oak, but used wood casks ever since the fall of Rome, because with the fall of Rome came in Western Europe the end of the old amphorae, which were pretty successful containers in keeping air out. Oak barrels weren't that good at this, or not necessarily oak, wooden barrels weren't that good at this, pardon me, because wood is, as we all know, porous and brings some air in. And especially when some wine was emptied out of a barrel, there would be, let's say, two-thirds of the barrel full of wine and one-third full of air, and the wine's going to turn into vinegar very quickly. But people used wooden barrels for going all the way back to the 5th century AD. People started using oak barrels in specifically for certain kinds of wines in certain places to help impart certain flavors. At the end of the 18th century, into the 19th century, they used them primarily in Bordeaux, primarily and also in Burgundy, which were two of the most prestigious sources of wine at the time. And when quality winemaking spread across the globe in the 20th century, people imitated those practices. They still imitate those practices. Wineries in California, for example, tend to, when working with grapes like Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon, tend to prefer to use French oak barrels than American or any other kind of oak barrels, claiming that those barrels impart exactly the taste that they want. Well, why is it exactly the taste that they want? Because it's the taste that echoes the French wines.
Trudy, thanks for your call.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
You bet. Take care. My guest is Paul Lucas, author of Inventing Wine. Coming up, we're going to hear from the author of a book about the Ohio wine, Ohio wines. It's called Ohio Wine Country Excursion. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Both sides fire metaphors at the fiscal cliff. President Obama said Republicans offer nothing but a lump of coal. Speaker John Boehner said the president's offer comes from La La Land. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin returns, plus Congressman Jason Chaffetz, Republican from Utah, as we continue conversations on the fiscal cliff. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins, and it's a discussion of the fate of the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the newspaper industry. That's on All Sides from 11 till noon. And it's 40 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, reaching a high near 45. Partly cloudy tonight, dropping down to a low of 28 degrees. Mostly sunny on Thursday with a high of 48, and then rain likely Thursday night, a low of 42 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from the State Auto Insurance Companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com. And remember, you can listen and watch All Sides with Ann Fisher live weekdays from 10 until noon. Just visit our website, wosu.org/allsides. And the program continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the history of wine with Paul Lucas, a James Beard Award winner and the author of the just-released Inventing Wine. Once again, Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And joining us now is Patricia Latimer. She's the author of the book Ohio Wine Country Excursions. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thank you. Good morning.
Paul, we were talking a little earlier about things that change the course of winemaking and so forth, and I wanted to ask Patricia about that as well, including the idea of the natural disaster and how that changed things. There have been different disasters throughout the ages that changed what we drank or how we drank it?
Yes, and I think a very good example of that would be in Cincinnati in I'd say the mid to late 1800s, when Nicholas Longworth, who was a passionate grower and producer, discovered that his desire to produce sparkling wine, champagne, could turn on a dime, and it happened due to the fact that there were any number of diseases like powdery mildew and something called black rot, which caused the various plants and the vineyards to have difficulty continuing, and they were attacked. They attacked the vine and the fruit. The black rot is often attributed to soil or climate or cultivation. And also the powdery mildew, on the other hand, had ravaged vineyards already at an earlier time in Europe before it wiped out ones in Ohio.
So, Paul Lucas, that has changed things in Europe as well over time. Is there anything recent, any kind of recent disasters that have caused problems?
Well, I'm not sure I would call them natural disasters. You're certainly right that Nicholas Longworth, who was really the father of American wine, of aspirations in America, had his vineyards devastated by diseases. They were devastated by diseases because the grape he used primarily was the Catawba grape, which is a hybrid of a Native American grape and a European grape, and the European ancestry in it made it susceptible to these diseases. And the biggest infestation that wine grapes are susceptible to is a tiny aphid-like insect called phylloxera, which in the second half of the 19th century destroyed wine vineyards all across the world. It destroyed every vineyard in Europe, with a couple of tiny plot exceptions, but essentially wiped out winemaking in Europe for a period of time, destroyed all winemaking in California, destroyed all winemaking in South Australia, places where making wine with classic wine grapes had come to. Everybody thought this had been eradicated by around the First World War. The phylloxera infestation was finished, but quite recently, in the late 1980s and the 1990s, California was again hit by phylloxera. And many, many, many of the state's finest vineyards had to be replanted because this little microscopic aphid insect was eating all the roots of the vines.
Do they have to move the vineyards when that happens?
No, they have to plant. They have to dig up the sick vines and plant phylloxera-resistant roots, because one of the interesting things about grapes is that the choice of grape depends upon the plant material, not upon the roots. So the way that all of Europe's vineyards, for example, back in the end of the 19th century were saved was that they grafted onto Native American rootstock, which are resistant to phylloxera, the Chardonnay, the Cabernet, the Merlot, the Riesling they had been growing for generations, if not centuries. And lo and behold, it produced Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon. And Riesling, it didn't produce any strange hybrid-y American foxy-tasting wines. So it's grafting that is the solution to this infestation. But it was one way to think of it is that you know, sort of patriotic Americans often say, well, we American rootstock saved all the vineyards of Europe, and which is absolutely true. There would be no Burgundy or Bordeaux or great German Riesling if there wasn't for American rootstock. Of course, before we saved them, we sent phylloxera over to Europe and killed all the great vineyards of Europe. So there's a bit of irony in our
some interesting political parallels, perhaps.
Yeah, one can draw all kinds of connections, which I'm not going to do.
Right. Patricia Latimer, when did winemaking in Ohio take off? Because it always surprises me. I moved to Ohio 25 years ago, and, you know, that's when I learned about, Kelly's Island and that sort of thing and winemaking out there. But it's much bigger than that.
Well, in terms of the scope of the writing that I did, a lot of this started, for instance, in the Cincinnati area, like in 1813, Longworth was testing the best varietals suitable for the Ohio River Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure Paul probably has some examples of something earlier than that, where they got started, and it was over several decades, almost three decades, before they really found the grapes that seemed to do well in the Ohio River Valley, and that would be the Catawba that was mentioned earlier.
And that was?
Well, the Catawba is a wine grape. It's classified as a Vitis labrusca grape, and it has some nuances of classic Vitis vinifera, from which the noble varieties come. But it's a coveted 150-year-old Eastern variety that has a bold texture and dark green foliage with flowers that self-fertilize. It's sort of purplish-red, medium-sized berries produce a clean, austere wine. But what was so interesting about this is that this Catawba wine flourished along the Ohio River and southern Lake Erie and the Finger Lakes, and it was originally used for making sparkling wine, still wine, and grape juice. And out of this came the very exciting first commercial vineyards in America, and those were in the 1830s in Cincinnati and in the agricultural lands along the Ohio River.
Which is kind of interesting. Was there much of a market for it?
I think it developed.
Okay.
Not initially, but...
Have wine, will drink.
Yeah, and the actual wine boom in Ohio took place in about 1842, and Nicholas Longworth, that I've mentioned before, he was very set on making the most of this opportunity. So he designed a 60,000-bottle cellar for the production of classic method Champenoise sparkling Catawba. And then later, in 1851, he developed a second cellar for 75,000 bottles.
Ohio was also the birthplace, or at least the womb of the abolitionist movement, and the abolitionist movement,
on the tip of the tongue. I know.
Right, yeah.
Prohibitionist movement.
Prohibitionist,
yep.
Thank you.
Yes.
Prohibitionist movement. And I was wondering if that had, I wanted to talk largely about that, the issue of prohibitionism and how it affected winemaking in Ohio, and then also, you know, in a greater sense, the whole Prohibition era.
Okay. Well, I do know that, in 1858, the town of, Westerville,
yeah.
Ohio, excuse me.
A suburb of Columbus,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. The town was officially incorporated, and a year later they banned the sale of or barter or gift of wine, fermented cider, beer, and other spirited liquors. That controversy was to affect the history of Westerville in the United States for more than a century. And so over time, various groups sort of grew out of this, and in terms of really making temperance movement was mm-hmm. very strong.
What about the larger winemaking industry during Prohibition, Paul Lucas? What kind of impact did that policy have on the industry?
Prohibition and the movements leading to Prohibition in the United States had the long-term effect of cheapening wine in various ways. It cheapened wine in that quality wine became something that very few people made. The Volstead Act, which was the actual law that ruled the land during the years of Prohibition, allowed home winemaking. So people bought grape. People in big eastern cities like New York and Chicago and Cleveland and Philadelphia bought grapes, usually shipped from California, and made wine at home in buckets and bathtubs and such. These wines were obviously not of the best quality. Largely because even if the person making them knew lots about making wine, the grapes had sat in rail cars for 3 weeks before they got to somebody who was going to make wine with them.
Mm-hmm.
But it also cheapened wine because it perpetuated the perception that wine was just another form of liquor. Wine was booze. In the same way that moonshine was booze, in the same way that gin was booze, in the same way that the stuff served in roadhouses and saloons was booze,
mm-hmm.
And that cheapening, that cheapening of the popular perception of wine, remained until I would say it begins to change in the 1970s, when wine begins to separate itself from other beverages and more people begin to think of it as a food beverage and more people begin to think of it as something with a historic sophistication to it or potential sophistication that other drinks might not have. And it lasts so long because the laws that were enacted in all 50, well, originally 48 and then all 50 states, following Prohibition, allowed the states to govern the sale of all quote-unquote intoxicating beverages. And as a result of that, wine became distributed and sold by the same people who were selling whiskey.
What about wartime? What happened to, say, Ohio vineyards during World War II when things were so rationed and that sort of thing? Patricia Latimer, how did they survive?
Well, what happened, the repeal of Prohibition,
mm-hmm.
brought hope to a handful of Ohio wineries who applied for licenses and planted new vineyards, but the demand for the grapes never materialized, and the commercial wine growers were left the industry in droves. World War II brought a renewed interest in grapes and an upturn in the wine sales, but it was the tumultuous 60s that brought dramatic change to the Ohio wine industry when Tim Hubbard and his partner Ernie Ester planted Cabernet Chardonnay in Johannesburg Riesling in northeast Ohio.
And what about in Europe, Paul Lucas? I just can't imagine they didn't destroy a lot of vineyards there at the time.
Both World Wars were cataclysmic for wine production. And for the perception and cultural understanding of wine. The First World War took place in many of the world's then most hallowed vineyards. It devastated, for example, the region of Champagne, which was the heart of trench warfare. The Second World War was almost as bad, less because of what happened in vineyards as because of the severe rationing of beverages by the Allies and the confiscation of fine wines by the Germans. And it went along with a general pattern in the first half of the 20th century of wine losing its allure for many customers and many consumers. The chic drink of choice in the first half of the 20th century was always the cocktail, not the glass of wine. And wine has regained and acquired new status in the second half of the 20th century and now the beginning of the 21st century, but it had largely lost it in the first half of the 20th century.
And what brought it back?
I think two things brought it back. One, as in Patricia's nice phrase, the tumultuous 60s led to real changes in what people ate and drank, and changes that are still being affected today. It's the very beginning of the organic movement and all the rest of such in terms of the foodstuffs that people in the West eat and drink. Equally important, maybe even more important, were advances in science and technology that raised the quality of wine immeasurably. As late as the 1960s, there was a huge chasm between what we would call fine wine and what we would call ordinary wine. Ordinary wine was usually pretty sour, pretty acrid, pretty non-distinct. Fine wine had people being rhapsodic about it, but they didn't have much in common. Today, ordinary wine is modeled after fine wine. It's made from the same grape varieties. It's made in the same image.
For the rest of us.
and for the people who want a $10 bottle of wine on Tuesday night with supper. And that's been a radical change.
Paul Lucas, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure.
Paul Lucas, he's the author of Inventing Wine, and Patricia Latimer, author of Ohio Wine Country Excursions. Thanks for joining us, Patricia. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.